everyone, and welcome to minute 147 of season 8 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we foobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Mark Hoffmeyer of Movies, Films, and Flicks, and the Deep Blue Sea Pod.
You know, if you take your Blue Yeti mic, smack it on a table, and then throw it, an entire podcast episode comes out of it. Just want you to know.
Does it work that way?
Yeah.
I did not know.
Yep. So just get a bunch of them. And if you want a bunch of content, just smack them and throw them.
I'll keep that in mind if I ever need to.
You can be the Charles E. Kelly, Charles Commando Kelly of podcasting. Did you get that reference?
No, I did not.
So this chapter, Charles E. Kelly is the one known for that. He won a Medal of Honor for.
Okay. I actually did read that someone won a Medal of Honor for it, but I didn't remember the guy's name.
They call him the one-man army at Salerno.
Actually, I heard it was a guy named Buford Andy Anderson did it.
Oh, well, I'm looking at Charles E. Kelly. And then from us, well, I mean, maybe they both did. He won. I know Charles E. Kelly won a Medal of Honor for that. So that's pretty cool. So, yeah, Charles E. Kelly, he used mortar shells as hand grenades in Italy in 1943. And they said the scene is based on the real-life tactics of Medal of Honor winner Charles Commando Kelly, who used 60-millimeter mortar shells as grenades.
Interesting.
Uh-oh, okay. There's two of them out there.
There are. So here you have, we're jumping ahead of ourselves, but people are listening to this, they'll figure it out. So you have Buford Theodore Andy Anderson was awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions during World War II during the Battle of Okinawa. The Japanese launched a counterattack against the American battalion. Many were wounded, and they were out of grenades. Out of desperation, he picked up an enemy mortar dud and threw it back at them. The explosion killed several Japanese. With that, he then took a box of 60-millimeter mortar rounds, pulled their safety pins one by one, smashed them on rocks, and then football threw them to the enemy troops while alternating firing his carbine. By the time the counterattack stopped, he'd already thrown 14 mortar rounds.
What year was that? Okinawa, was that 44? 43?
Okinawa was 45.
45? Got it. Yeah, because the Pacific didn't start.
Right. Okinawa was April, I think April or May 45.
Got it. Yeah, so Kelly did it in 43.
That's Hacksaw Ridge.
What?
Okinawa. Hacksaw Ridge was Okinawa.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. That's a gnarly one. I would never, yeah. That wall was horrible to climb up.
Yeah. Okay, but again, based on what you just said, so. What makes more sense is that Ryan heard about it from Kelly and Anderson heard about it from Ryan because of the timeline.
That makes sense.
This is June 44. So, okay. You see, kudos all around.
And we got there. So we got before, during, and after.
That's right.
I like
exactly.
It.
Exactly. Okay. So that's right. No problem. Minute 147 begins with Upham trying to keep it together.
Keep it together.
That's right. A shout out to
Bowfinger.
Where's that from? Bowfinger.
Jay and I did the minutes on that. I love that movie.
That's right. So, shout out to Jim O'Kane, friend of the show,
yep. You know,
who produced that Movies by Minute season. And this minute ends with Miller throwing an improvised explosive. So basically, yesterday we ended things with Upham crying on the stairs. And today we start the minute with him still crying on the stairs. Now, it's just unbelievable how much time Spielberg is using in this movie to show us Upham crying on the stairs. I mean, this is already a 2-hour-and-49-minute movie. You would think that, you know, Spielberg would be at least somewhat cautious in wasting any seconds in this movie. You know, you want to keep people enthralled for 3 hours, so you know you're gonna cut out what you don't need. So the fact that he's keeping this in for so long says that Spielberg finds this really, really important.
I mean,
that's my point.
The character moments are why this movie works. If this movie was 2 hours, it wouldn't have the legacy it does. This movie works because. When everybody dies or cries or yells SOB after getting shot, you care for them and you know them. And there's time for arguments. There's time for monologues. There's time for Matt Damon improvising and wrecking the continuity of the movie. There's time for characters that have scenes. So I think that's what makes this movie. And I think it also drenches the audience in sadness a little bit. This movie is very mathematically sound too, because there's an initial battle, and then you get like Vin Diesel being killed, then Ribisi gets killed, and then you just slowly move through the action scenes with each beat. Like math, I think it's maybe one of the most mathematically sound films based on highs and lows for the audiences. It knows how to like tear you. It knows how to feature the action, get you up, then it rips your heart out, and then it gets you up, and then it rips your heart. Like, it's a very mathematically sound film. So I think the fact that he sits there for so long is a testament to the film.
I agree with you 100%, but my point is that in this minute, we see him for 11 seconds bawling, and he was already bawling for at least 2 or 3 seconds beforehand, if not more. So, you know, there's a difference between, you know, being frugal. There's a difference between, okay, wanting to show these character moments on the other hand, but on the other hand, you got to think about how much time are you going to devote to that? Yeah. And, you know, when you look at a movie minute by minute, you realize how much time is used. I'm not even going to use the word wasted, but how much time is used for each shot or each scene and stuff like that. More so than when you're just sitting there watching the movie. Obviously, we know that Spielberg's a genius. There's no question about it. He knows how to make these things. So I'm not saying that he made a mistake by showing it for so long. My point is that I'm shocked that he spent so much time showing this. And we need to learn from the fact that he spent so much time showing it that there's a reason for it. You know, he wants us to see how devastated Upham is by his – maybe Upham is also shocked at his own actions. You know, that maybe he didn't realize that he would – I know yesterday you said I shouldn't call him a coward, but, you know, the fact that he at least is – berating himself that he didn't go try and save his friend in a moment of weakness. Let's put it that way. You know, a moment of weakness where he was somewhat cowardice.
I think that's a natural reaction, though. Everyone kicks themselves for things. Like, I think, let's say someone wants, let's say there's a person out there who has a crush on someone. They can't even bring themselves to talk to the person because they're so scared. They'll probably kick themselves later for it. So this one's times 4,000. Like, you didn't save someone.
This is also a life and death situation.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, imagine how scared people are just to go up to somebody and talk to them. Now, imagine him going into a room and killing a guy who's killing, you know, Mellish. And I think he's in shock. He's feared. He's a coward, but he's also frozen in fear. There's a lot going through this guy. So I think... Yeah, I think it's good to live in that moment for a while. It's good to see that. It's good to see that he, because if he would have recovered immediately, just be like, oh, hey, and run away, that wouldn't work. That scene would fail. I think we needed him on that thing for what you said, 14, 15 seconds, just to show how frozen he is.
Correct. And again, he's frozen, but he's also has the state of mind to motion to this German guy.
Put his hand out.
You know, he's like, he takes his hand off the gun and basically says, look, I'm not going to shoot you. Just go. You know, you're safe.
Up him.
Yeah, perfect. Up him.
There's a lot of tank time in this clip too.
Yes. Yes. We will get there shortly. So after we get all these, moments of up him on the stairs, you know, where he just completely has lost it. There's no question about it. Then we get a shot of one of the burning tanks, and the camera takes us around the tank that has lost the treads. We see all the bodies scattered all over the place also, you know, just to remind us of all the carnage of everything that's going on up until now. And then we see in the distance another one of the Tiger tanks, you know, getting closer with the you know, we see a German officer in the turret with another German soldier next to him on the tank itself. And then there's another guy walking on the ground. And it's just getting closer to us. And the two guys on the tank are talking to one another. And I love the fact that, again, we don't understand what they're saying because they're saying in German. But there's so much noise from the tank that they're right next to each other and they're shouting at one another.
Sound design's so incredible.
Yes. Yes. I mean, this movie definitely deserved both its Oscars for sound in, you know, because of the way that they did it.
If it lost to Sound to Shakespeare in Love, I think I just would have quit. I don't know what I would have quit, but I just would have quit everything. And the winner for best sound, Shakespeare in Love. I was like, what?
Well, that was the reaction everyone had for Best Picture, but yeah.
Yeah. I still remember that.
So do I. It was Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford opened up the you know the envelope and announced it, and he just goes, "Shakespeare in Love." I was like, "What?"
Yeah, that's when I kind of realized the Oscars were not a joke, but they were politics. And then I read about how they did it. But yeah,
Yes.
at least it won sound design and sound, because just, you know, I read about how they captured the sound with the rifles and how specific they were with everything. And just incredible. Just incredible. Oh,
Seriously.
man.
Right. So the tank stops and the two of them are talking and we see, you know, still the smaller tank on fire right in front of us. And then the soldier on the tank gets down and starts motioning to I guess his men to which direction to go. And then the tank itself starts moving backwards. And the tank commander is you know giving instructions. We're not sure if he's instructing his driver or some of the guys around him, but he's basically moving backwards. And then the shot changes, and we're back with Miller, and Miller says, "I'm out." And Ryan just looks at him and goes, "Hey, there's 60 rounds." And he goes, "We can use them without a tube." And then and Miller says, "How?" He goes, "Fuse arming wire, set back, heave it." And, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this minute. You know, this is something that has been done before and will be done after, but we don't know if Ryan knew about this or not. Apparently, Robert Rodat knew about it in order to add it into the script. But besides that, it's actually very interesting. I mean, when I was in the army, I also dealt with mortars, and the rounds that we dealt with of the 60s didn't have a pin on them that you had to pull, which is very interesting.
Oh,
Maybe
geez.
because they already had gotten them ready for us? No, I don't think so. I don't recall. Maybe back during World War II, that's what they still had. You know, I don't know. But the idea of banging on the bottom of the you know of a mortar rocket and not expecting it to explode on the spot is what's scary to me. I mean, again, you'd think that it works. I mean, again, it works the same way as a gun. You know, the whole idea is that you have, you know, a hammer that's gonna start a chain reaction inside of a projectile. You know, in a gun, so you have the gunpowder. Here you have explosives in it that are gonna be doing something. So it initially, you know, will fly out and then it lands wherever it's supposed to land. You know, a bullet goes straight and mortars go in an arc. But, you know, I would think that if you're gonna bang on the bottom of a mortar, you know, you it's gonna explode. It's not gonna wait a few seconds to explode from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think, but I mean, Kelly pulled it off. Like, it's been pulled off
Yeah,
before, so
true.
I
You're
mean,
right.
you know what makes the scene, since I know so little about it, but he's like, fuse arming wire. So you just know it, whatever it does, it sets the fuse and you have time to throw it. It's like those sticky grenades that blew that dude up. Oh
Sticky
my
bomb.
gosh,
Sticky
that's
bomb. Yes. Oh, wow.
That's one of the most memorable moments, I think. I've just watched, you're a maniac, Spielberg. That seems crazy. But yeah, I mean, what else are you gonna do? I think at that scene, and also I think Hank's time on A League of Their Own helped him out in this scene because he is winging him.
That's right. That's right. But he was a manager. He wasn't really throwing the ball, but still, you know.
He played baseball, did he not, before that?
He played beforehand, sure.
Yeah. I
Jimmy
mean,
Dugan.
you know.
Jimmy Dugan got into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, pees a lot.
Yes. Well, come on. We know that Tom Hanks pees in most movies that he's in. You know, I know that someone had put up a post. This was years ago, back when I first started blogging. So it's got to be at least 10, 12 years since someone did since that guy did it. And he had a list of every Tom Hanks movie that was related to Tom Hanks peeing. You know, I think this is the only movie where he doesn't pee in or something like that. Because you got The Green Mile where he has trouble peeing, and you got Captain Phillips where he escapes by pretending that he has to go pee. You got A League of Their Own, Forrest Gump. You know,
yeah, I gotta pee.
Does he pee in? Well, and Biggie pretends to pee. So yeah, I mean, Tom Hanks is a peer.
He's a great. He's cinema's great peer. Him and Leslie right. Nielsen.
Well, Leslie Nielsen just did it once, but he just did it so loud and on microphone
and so long.
It makes us think. Exactly, it makes us think that you know. And that police commissioner will never forget that.
I'm glad you picked up on that reference. But no, I mean, listen, it's just the ingenuity of the scene. Also, I think it's important that you establish Ryan as someone who's industrious in this scene. If Ryan was just a wet noodle, then this would not work. But the fact that he can come up with this, the fact that he wants to stay, the fact that he listens to Ryan, but like it's a good scene, and that Hanks has laser, like he's very accurate. He chucks the last one a good distance.
Yeah,
I mean you want to get him that far away.
Correct. But
I mean that's a high risk, high reward tactic, though.
Correct.
Like that's what you I mean, do yeah. last.
Well, and they're at that point. They yeah. don't have any bullets left, so that's what they got to do. You know,
to start throwing rocks.
Now, my question is when they set this up, I mean, I've talked about this numerous times, you know, that this is like the A-team scenes, you know, when they were getting the town ready, you know, for the whole thing. So what was their plan for these mortars? You know, if these mortars are in the spot where Ryan and Miller are defending, so they needed to have a plan. They're not just going to leave them there. Was the plan to use mortars? I mean, mortars, you have to have a distance for.
The two.
So you need to have them further away if that was the plan.
Because I didn't see a tube in there, did you?
No.
Maybe someone was carrying the mortars and just left them there when things hit the fan.
60, the 60 millimeter mortar is not something you put on your back. Yeah, they're smaller ones. You have like the 52s where you put on your back and you can carry them. They're more mobile. The 60 needs to be grounded.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, again, it's a little strange to me that they do it. There. Okay, once again, there is a mortar in front of him. There is a tube in front of him.
Oh, okay. They just don't have time for the tube.
Right, but again, why place the tube there if you're not going to have any use for it? You should be placing the tube maybe on the other side of the Alamo. That makes more sense that you're going to be able to shoot from there if you need to.
You know, so many people got killed on that tank when they brought that big gun in.
Yes.
That messed up a lot. So maybe they thought we'll take the tube to the Alamo, but we'll keep it here just in case. Maybe we can pepper them as they're coming over. So it's...
Okay.
You're right. Putting it on the Alamo is smarter, but they were just going to blow it up anyway. So I don't think they were too. I think that was, the Alamo was just, we're going to blow this bridge up. Last, that's our last resort. So yeah, it's very plot convenient, I would say. Yeah,
I was going to say the reason it's there is because it fits with in the script. That's
yeah.
it. That's the explanation.
You know what's a great point though? Because people went, can that happen? And then they realized it can happen, so then they completely forgot why they were there. You know what's a good movie when you don't think about that until 27 years later? At least for me.
No, I agree with you. I'm the same way. Yeah. You know, even though I know about mortars, I never thought about it till I was doing my research here, and I'm like, wait a second. Can you actually do that? And again, this goes with the comment that you made earlier. There was no internet back or less people were on the internet in 1998 when this came out, that people weren't going to be going to check. See, you know, did anyone win a Medal of Honor? Hey, there's two guys that won Medals of Honor for taking, you know, mortar shells and banging them on the rocks and throwing them. you know, use them as grenades. So, you know, you got to give a lot of credit to Robert Rodat for having that research and information when he wrote this.
I agree.
So that's great. Okay, so that's all I have for this minute. Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
Great arm. Great at peeing, great at throwing.
That's right. All right, so every Tuesday we have a segment called Tom Hanks Tuesday, where my guests will give me their top five Tom Hanks performances. So, Mark, why don't you start at your number five and work your way up?
All right, Bridge of Spies, 2015. He is so good as James B. Donovan that I don't think people knew how good he is. Like it's a great performance, but I think it came at a point in his career where everyone just knew he was great. And so when people watch it, they're like, yeah, he's great. But he's so sly. That opening scene where he's just like he's wheeling and dealing, and just the cold that he has. It's just such a great performance. I love it so much. That's easily my number five. Number four, A League of Their Own. He's just a ball of anger and urine. And I love it so much. Throwing the glove at the kid. And I think anybody who acts with Geena Davis is going to be better because I just love Geena Davis's delivery. I think she just has the perfect delivery. So that's my five and four. Oh my gosh. This was tough. I'm still flipping through here. I just want to say Larry Crown is probably my least favorite movie ever made. Just want to put that out there for everybody so you know that.
Your least favorite movie of Tom Hanks or in
No, I
general?
think it's one of the movies I've hated the most in my life ever watching.
Really interesting.
I just don't. Yeah, I don't know. That's not it. That's
Okay.
not it for me. All right. Next, I'm going to go with Big because. You know, he had made a name for himself. People liked him in a lot of his films. But Big was, you know, his first big nominated film. He had to play a kid, so he had to have this energy, but he also had to make it kind of normal. I think that showed a different element to him. So I have Slick Hanks, I have Drunk Hanks, and I have Kid and an Adult Body Hanks, which I think is really good. Next, I'm gonna take Saving Private Ryan just because it was a little bit against type. For him to play this, but never once did I doubt Hanks in this movie. Like his physicality, his leadership, you know, he's great in Greyhound too, by the way. Really good movie, very
Yeah,
efficient
I'm a
film.
big fan of Greyhound.
Yeah, my brother's he's in the Air Force and he loves it. He thinks it's like one of the best shows of leadership in a film. But I was so on board with him. In that, it's okay. So that's that. Oh man. And then, I have some huge ones left. I have Philadelphia. I have Forrest Gump. I have Castaway. Not Green Mile. Apollo 13, he's so good in, man. Oh my gosh. Sleepless in Seattle and You've Got Mail. That's romance. Joe versus the Volcano. Number one. Oh, Philadelphia. He loses weight for a lot of roles. I don't care. I'm gonna go with Forrest Gump. The phys he, in that movie, he pulls off like physicality, fighting. He's fully committed to the bit. I'm gonna go with Forrest Gump, number one.
That is a great list. Thank you very much for that, Mark. Would you like to tell everyone where they can find Mark Hoffmeyer?
Yeah, they can find me improvising explosives in ditches in France. And also at moviesfilmsandflicks.com, Movies, Films, and Flicks, the podcast, and Deep Blue Sea, the podcast.
And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can send me an email at movierobminute@movierob.net. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Facebook. And you can find me on Twitter. So, until tomorrow, earn this.
Ernest.
My solitude, you haunt me with reveries of death. on by.